Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, March 22nd. I'm Ray Graff. Time once again for the Science Forum on the show, and we welcome back our esteemed panel of experts, or panel of esteemed experts, to field all of your questions today. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. We're down a person on the panel today, usually three. Today we have two, so you be the third and give us a call at 800-348-2551. You can also email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. Get your questions ready. Get in line. It's the Science Forum. It begins after the news. Hi, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's time to reconvene the Science Forum on Vox Pop, and our number is 800-348-2551. If you have a science question, you never know where this program will go. Sometimes it's about hanging laundry. Sometimes it's about bubble wrap. You never know. And we'll find out as the show progresses. It's 800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Let's meet our panel of experts.
Hi, it's Barbara Brabets.
Hi.
SUNY Kowalskill. I am a biochemist, so I usually handle questions about biology and chemistry.
Well, that's good.
That's a good start.
That's appropriate.
Yeah.
And what about the other one?
Ed Stander. I'm the other half of the SUNY Kowalskill contingent today, and I handle geology and astronomy, so anything it has to do with the center of the Earth to the edge of the universe, I have to cover.
Well, that's pretty impressive. And our third is not here today. He's on vacation. So
hi, Jim, wherever you are in a warm, sunny climate.
Hopefully it is warm and sunny. That is correct.
We would hope.
Now, on the last program we did, there was some homework.
Yes. We had a caller who described a situation that he had run into. He had ordered some food. I think he was a foodie. He ordered some food on the internet, and it was delivered with a dry ice packet rather than an ice pack.
Yeah.
And so when he opened it up, along with the fact that his food was fine and still frozen, the bubble wrap was inflated, he thought, and he wanted us to explain it. So we took it on as homework because Ed frankly didn't like my explanation, if I remember correctly.
What was your explanation?
My explanation was that the gas
was somehow infiltrating.
So dry ice is solid carbon dioxide, and when it vaporizes, it would increase the pressure inside the box, and that the gas would diffuse through the bubble wrap and thereby inflate. When the box is opened, there would be a period of time that it would take for the bubble wrap to deflate back to normal atmospheric pressure.
Okay. And Ed didn't like that.
I had my own idea.
And what was your idea?
I thought that the trick was that temperatures of dry ice temperature that the plastic became harder. And so as a result, when you pushed into the bubble, it would feel a little bit more difficult to push in.
So it was
fooling
you.
It would appear
to
be heavier.
And what did our homework entail?
Well, I did not actually do a tension test on the bubbles, but I did take bubble wrap, and I didn't have any dry ice. So what I did instead is tested the theory that the bubbles are not hermetically sealed, that it was possible for gas to diffuse through
them.
So what I did is I took my tub and I took some bubble wrap of varying types, and I put a heavy weight on them and I drowned them.
Okay.
And then I looked after a suitable time, I'd say probably the length of one episode of, I don't know, Big Bang Theory. Or Science Forum. And then I went back to the bathtub and I tried to resuscitate my bubble wrap. And it turned out that, yes, water had indeed infiltrated into the little inch-wide bubbles. I used that kind of big bubble wrap, the one with the satisfying pop.
Yeah.
And then I also used the Amazon not-so-satisfying pop bubble wrap, kind of those wedges that look like little loaves of bread that are kind of hermetically sealed.
Mm-hmm.
That one was not as successful with the water infiltration.
It's very interesting because then that tells you that you couldn't use this for a really long period of time.
And that not all of the bubbles would have popped with a satisfying pop, because if they have air infiltration, if you try to pop them, they'll just kind of So
would you say the results then are conclusive for your theory?
I think that they support the theory that, yes, gas could infiltrate this kind of the quarter-sized bubble wrap, and that it would create a momentary increase in pressure inside the box until the box is unsealed, and then, of course, the gas would escape.
Counterpoint, Ed Stander.
Well, my feeling is that much, much more research is necessary, and we'll be putting together a National Research Council grant or National Science Foundation grant to determine exactly what's happening.
I think there is an ignoble prize in our future if we figure this out, Ed.
At the very least.
Yes.
I think we probably already qualified for some ignoble prizes.
I think now that we've set our line in the sand by being on broadcast radio and saying that this is what we're doing for our research studies.
I trust you'll invite us in once we win.
Yes, this is the sort of broadcasting you can expect in public radio. And the number is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum, 800-348-2551. If you have a question about anything scientific, this is the time. Ed, you wanted to talk about ice.
Well, I figured that since we're still in a pre-glacial period out there.
Is it not equinox? Did I not see that the sun passed an equator at some point in time?
You know, the worst of it is that Cobleskill still has about 2 feet of snow on it.
Yeah.
And I'm supposed to be teaching field geology this weekend, so I'm going to be teaching instead. I'll be teaching the relationship between snow and the rocks underneath it.
You know, I think they should get phys ed credit for your class, too. You hand them all a shovel because they got to get to the dirt.
Right. Well, there are a lot of lakes that are still frozen.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I've been studying is how they freeze and what happens as the ice crystals first start to form. And it's pretty cool. It turns out that the first crystals that form when you have an ice sheet are, they look like snowflakes, but they're little flat plates, and they float to the surface. And if it's a very quiet night when it first freezes, all those little plates that come to the surface start to spread out and you get very large crystals.
Mm-hmm.
But the ice grows very slowly. And as a result, as it grows, it exudes all its air and it looks very dark. So if you ever walk on a lake, for example, and you see it's black ice, the reason is that it froze on a very quiet night when the crystals came to the top and then grew very large.
Interesting.
But if you have a wind when the ice first freezes, then those little plates get all mashed up. And as a result, the ice grows downward, but it grows much faster downward. You get a much thicker sheet, and all the air gets trapped in it. And as a result, you get white ice.
Huh. So that I did not know.
Yeah,
what
so
about clear ice? Is clear ice just a combination?
Clear ice is black ice, effectively. It has no air pockets in it because it grows so slowly that the air actually gets the air doesn't get trapped by the ice. And so you can actually see the fish underneath trying to breathe this stuff.
It is the Science Forum on WAMC Vox Pop. It's call-in show. 800-348-2551 is the number. Ed Stander is here and Barbara Brabitz to answer your science questions. Let's go to Bob in Albany. Bob, you're on.
Hi, I guess this one's for Ed. Some time ago, I called into the science program to ask about whether there was an upper limit to how hot something can get. And I was told essentially no, because the pressure of collapsing stars creates an inconceivably hot situation with no known outer edge. So that means now, to my thinking, that we've got three infinite things going. We've got the universe itself, we've got the pressure that could create an infinite heat, so it must be an infinite pressure, and infinite heat. And I'm just wondering if I'm right about in my understanding and if there are any other infinites besides hubris, which is a human infinite.
Well done.
Well, You're absolutely right that when you have a large star like Betelgeuse that decides to collapse, you're talking about billions of degrees in temperature. At least those are the mathematical results of studies of it. And you've got very, very high pressures. Now, what happens when you get to a high enough pressure that everything collapses on itself and you wind up with something like a black hole or a neutron star? That's a very good question. That seems to me that would be the ultimate, the point where the pressures and temperatures have become so high that your matter has effectively shrunk to zero. And that would be a limitation to it. I don't think you can get hotter than that.
And isn't that kind of where grand unified theory comes together, where we go from gravitational forces to the individual forces of pressure, temperature, heat, energy?
Sure, that was the point of the Big Bang, for example, that we can't go back past, at least right now, we don't have enough energy even in the universe, or at least in our hands, to go back past a certain point, which right now is, I think, around 10 to the minus 31st after the Big Bang occurred. So things could have been worse then. Who knows?
That neither heat nor pressure are actually infinite, but they can be the pressure can be so enormous
sure.
that it creates an equally enormous heat. Mm-hmm. And at this point, beyond knowing, we don't know, like with absolute zero, what the absolute heat or absolute pressure might be.
Well, the good thing is that numbers are also infinite. So we can always come up with a number to say what's going on in them. That's about as far as you can go.
Well, Bob, thanks for the call. Our number here is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum on WAMC. Barbara Brabitz is here, and Ed Stander, also from SUNY Cobleskill. Wow, two.
It's a hotbed of scientific intrigue.
And you're doing fermentation now?
Well, we're planning on it.
Really?
We're developing a program to look at fermentation in all its many, many colored splendors.
And what brought this on?
Well, a lot of us spend a lot of time thinking about fermentation.
Okay, all right.
Are you volunteering, Ray? I bourbon.
This isn't Friday,
bourbon?
You know.
It is not Friday yet.
But we could get graduated from Thursday to Friday, Ed, if we brought in some bourbon.
It's Friday somewhere. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. The Science Forum. We'll be back in a moment.
Support for Vox Pop on WAMC comes from Identity Eyewear, Albany, New York, specializing in distinctive eyewear featuring new styles for 2018. Eye exams by appointment, 518-459-2638. Colby Attorney's Service, corporate formations, document retrieval services, court filings, and legal publishing for the legal and professional community. Since 1939, ColbyService.com. Hooked Seafood Company in Galleria 7 Market, Latham. Fresh seafood retail market and kitchen with scratch-made lunch and dinner menu, raw bar, custom orders, and platters available. HookedSeafoodINC.com. And from Boyden & Pear in Amherst, Massachusetts, providing foreign and domestic car, truck, and SUV repair services, and a Massachusetts inspection station for over 50 years. BoydenAndPear.com.
Welcome back to Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. It's the Science Forum, and we have Ed Stander and Barbara Brabitz to answer your questions. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org, and this one came in from Ramon in Montgomery. What is the principle in science that logically applies the argument of absence of evidence is not evidence of absence for things like abiogenesis, something that has never been observed yet is considered sound science, and at the same time, the same principle and logic is used to confirm that there is no beings akin to things like God, supreme beings, because there is an absence of evidence.
Just ask us a little question there, Ray. Why
don't I love you?
It. It's just trivial, really, really
I
small
love
question.
This.
So let me give an example. If I were to take a being that does not have the ability to see the sun, say it lives at the base of the ocean, mm-hmm. and I describe to them the big yellow ball in the sky converting hydrogen to helium, putting out UV, putting out X-rays, putting out visible light, putting out infrared, it would seem like a fantastical being, yet much of their environment is crafted by the entity that I describe. But yet they would have very little way, if any way, to actually observe this or test the presence or absence of this thing, this big ball in the sky. So if we ourselves as a race have the inability to interpret information or observe a specific phenomenon without the assistance of some other thing like a radio or a microscope, then how do we know it's there? We have to know it by inference, or then there's the idea of faith. So
okay.
That's
well, Ramon goes on, not looking for some validation for either, but asking why the paradox, or what is the principle or metric applied to validate one notion and to discredit the other in the field of the sciences?
Well, that's always done by inference and testing. You come up with a model, you test your model, see whether that model works. If it doesn't work, then you go on to the next step and you try a different model. And what you're doing effectively is building a house of cards. And if all the cards stay up and they all fit together, then you say, well, that makes sense, until something comes to knock them down. And that's what scientists do.
So the idea of the speed of sound was a barrier. There were thoughts that the speed of sound, if anyone exceeded the speed of sound, that they would burst into flame, that they would collapse into themselves,
that
their brains
would
fry. Right. So we had all these theories, however cockamamie some of them were, that this barrier was not breachable. And it's true that the laws of physics and the laws of engineering, of physics really do change pre-speed of sound and post-speed of sound. There are differences in how things work, but the actual barrier itself was really a hurdle, not a barrier. Once we were through the barrier, we were able to compare the supersonic world to the subsonic world and see the math that supported both. I think there's one assumption in Ramon's letter that isn't really true. We can prove or disprove. It's actually easier to disprove the presence of something than it is to prove the presence of something. And we can't prove
the absence.
For instance,
dark matter.
Right. We know it's there.
Well, do we? Maybe our
it could be our math is off.
Or maybe our conceptions about gravity are incorrect.
Well, we may not be in this room. I mean,
this could just be all a hallucination.
Here we go, Ed.
But anyway, not to get too far afield, but in science, proving the absence of something is really difficult. Disproving the presence is easier.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Howard is in New Paltz. Howard, you're on.
Hey, how are you?
Hello.
I kind of have a combination of questions here. One is, I have a feeling that people are really freaking out, going crazy all over the planet. And some of the reasons I would think it would be genetically modified foods, cell phones, and Wi-Fis, which having a Wi-Fi in your house is more like being inside of a microwave oven most of the time. There's a lot of studies that can prove this, but I know that cell phone companies do not want you to have this because they'll be out of business. So I just want your feeling and your true opinion on this.
Okay. You want to hang on the line or you want to hang up, Howard?
Yeah, I'll hang on.
Go ahead.
Well, there have been lots and lots and lots of studies outside of the cell phone business talking about, for example, the electromagnetic forces coming from a cell phone and how weak they are, and the fact that there doesn't seem to be any evidence that it's causing anything to happen to people. My feeling in general is that the reason that people are acting perhaps a bit more harebrained or stranger than they normally are is because we're being inundated by so many more sources of media than we ever were in the past. And as a result, we're being hit in all directions by different ideas from different people, and we can't deal with that. Mankind has only had a brain, if you will, for about maybe 200,000 years. And we are really creatures we're not creatures of knowledge in that respect. We're not used to having so many things hitting us from all directions, and it becomes very difficult to deal with it.
Barbara.
That's a very interesting philosophy. The microwave radiation that a cell phone puts out, or Wi-Fi, which is really radio, in your house, kind of is in the same ballpark as the broadcast that we're putting out right now. It's radio waves. It's rather low energy light. I think there are some concerns about close contact. You know, back when we used to talk on cell phones, we don't do that anymore. But people were keeping them close to their head a lot. There was some evidence that if you were a very, very small child and that you were constantly on a cell phone, that perhaps there would be some localized effect, but only for skulls that were very, very thin. So the evidence, I've looked at this evidence because this has come up before, and the evidence is pretty shaky.
But we are bathed in RF. Everywhere
we go. And it's not just public radio and humankind. It's our sun. Our sun puts out radio. You can look at the Big Bang static on any kind of television. You just turn on and see that static pattern. That's the Big Bang. That's been around for 13.8 billion years.
Let's go back to the
We live with it. We live with it all the time.
More or less. 800-348-2551 is the number. Martin in Cahoes. Martin, you're on.
Hi. I remember reading about quantum weirdness. Einstein came across it in the 30s, called it spooky action at a distance.
Yeah.
And then I read an article in about 2008 two or three years ago where it said that if two particles are in an entangled state, the second particle will always correlate with measurements on the first particle, even when the second particle is far, far away.
Mm-hmm.
How does that work with the light speed? Doesn't seem to fit into that.
How?
Can you explain
that,
anything more about
question.
That to me?
Before you say how it works, and good luck with that,
yeah.
Tell us how they tested that. That's an interesting one where you say, well, gosh, how the heck are you going to test that? And I guess they figured out a way to do that.
Well, weren't they looking at the spin of electrons?
I don't think it was electrons, because the last time we had a call about this, I had to go back and look because I had thought it was electrons, and it wasn't.
You know, so, Martin, Bob Berman talks about this on almost every show that we do on the astronomy program. So if you want, give it a shot with him. Unless, Ed, you have something to add.
I have. If my twin were spinning in the right direction, I probably would, but otherwise, no.
All right. Well, we'll have to leave that one, Martin. Unless
and
you
the
guys...
answer is there is no how. We don't know how it works. We only know it works.
Right.
And doesn't that drive you nuts as a scientist?
It just means we have a job.
Yeah, and someday someone's going to figure it out and win the Nobel Prize for it, because that will allow effectively communication over vast distances for effectively nothing.
I would like my twin to go clean my toilet. So if we could figure out how to do that.
Well, that's
that,
only if you don't.
Correct.
Well, all right.
That's already an assumed
that's
state.
Well, the number here on this very fascinating program is 800-348-2551. Ed Stander is here and Barbara Brabets to answer your scientific questions. And Philip in Orange, Massachusetts. Philip, you're next.
Oh, thank you. This is for Ed.
Oh.
Stephen Hawking hypothesized that there was dark matter before there was dark energy. Before there was a universe, and the dark energy caused the Big Bang. Is that something you might agree with or disagree with?
There's about a dozen different models as to what happened before the Big Bang and why it happened. Some people think it's a universe that actually stepped into our universe and produced the energy that allowed it to happen. But at the moment, there's just no way to prove one way or another what actually happened at that moment, because we can't get back that far to actually see how matter was produced from energy.
It's like somebody took the Etch-a-Sketch and shook it at the Big Bang. So you have no idea what was on the Etch-a-Sketch before it was put in front of you. You have all the ingredients for ultimately millions of different combinations of pictures that could be on that Etch-a-Sketch. But once that Etch-a-Sketch is shaken, you can't get it back. So that's the problem with the Big Bang. We can't go beyond the reboot.
There is one piece of sort of very tempting information that may help the situation, and that's the fact that and I've mentioned this before, as the universe is expanding, the density of the universe is not changing.
Yep.
And normally, if you take anything and you expand it, the density will decrease, but it's not changing, which suggests that what's happening is that we're moving into something that's already there. The possibility that you have a universe outside of ours and we're effectively a bubble forming and moving into that universe. You can't prove it except for that one little piece of information. Now, if that's the case, then possibly what we are just a universe within a universe within a universe, and this may be what happens. The problem is that as you get further and further away from us towards the edge of what's the Big Bang, you're getting closer and closer to the speed of light in terms of distance. You don't know what's beyond that because none of that light or anything else has ever reached us. So we don't really know.
You never know where this show's going to go.
Right, you don't. We thought it was going to be bubble wrap.
we hoped, anyway.
The quantum bubble wrap conundrum. But one more piece to all of that. Uh-oh, did I just lose it? Oh, my twin must have it because I don't have it anymore.
Okay, well, maybe it'll come back to you. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's Vox Pop. It's the Science Forum. Let's go to Bob in Clifton Park. Bob.
Hi. I've been wondering about the mechanism for instinct. As I understand it, probably incorrectly, DNA codes for making proteins. How do these proteins result in instinctive behavior?
We have no idea. Next question.
Really?
Okay.
Really, no. What we do know is that there's a new technology called functional MRI, functional magnetic resonance. And so if anybody's ever had an MRI, like, you know, I don't know, like a hip or a bad shoulder, the MRI can tell us, based on density mapping, you know, what's inflamed, what's not. In a functional MRI, it's really more than that. It combines brain waves, brain activity with that kind of mapping. So it's able to see what parts of the brain light up and are communicating at the point that a thought is going on. So if I put you in an open MRI and I hold up a picture of a pink elephant and I say, imagine you riding the pink elephant, then we can image your brain and see where the pink elephant and your riding center is. Or we could do it while you're dreaming and then wake you up and ask what you're dreaming about. Well, the same is true with instinct. So they've started doing this with animals in controlled studies. They put them into very predictable instinctive behaviors, running from prey, eating, pouncing on prey, all the things that we're programmed to do, whether or not we have parental guidance, and then look at the functional MRI of those brains while they do it in order to try to see where it is. It's a small start. The next piece is to then look at what genes are being expressed and what proteins are being manufactured. That's a little bit more intensive, and that would require a sacrifice of the animal.
All right, Bob, thank you for the call. 800-348-2551. Well done, Barbara Brabitz. Also, Ed Stander here today. And let's go to Lisa in Milford. Lisa.
Yes, I was wondering. I have friends who I would say are, intelligent enough. But when they start talking about chemtrails, my head wants to explode. And I'll say things to them like, don't you think by now there'd be a really good video where you'd see someone actually spraying the stuff that causes the chemtrail, if this really were a thing? And I'm wondering if you have a really good article that I can give to people when they start acting, and this is a scientific term, loony about chemtrails.
Well, I can tell you that I spent quite a bit of time looking up the subject of chemtrails, and I can tell you that one of the best ways to prove that it doesn't exist is the fact that if you put any chemicals into JP4, which is the main jet propulsion fuel, the plane crashes. The stuff has to be absolutely pure, or there's major, major problems in the engine operation. Beyond that, it's a very, very hard thing to prove or disprove what's in these things because it's up there, but basically you can't do it.
Well, we've used the thought argument here before. Say there are 30 million scientists worldwide. It's a very conservative number. If we were part of this vast conspiracy to put stuff in jet fuel and spray it over the planet, don't you think we'd have moved to a part of the planet where we're not going to get inundated with it?
Exactly.
At a certain point, it's our friends and family who are getting inundated with it if we're putting it in there. So, it's kind of like those disaster movies where the guy knows that Godzilla is going to come. And so he gathers all of his people into a van and he makes a run for the border. You don't see scientists doing that. So that's my argument against chemtrails.
Well, on the other hand, there's no place on the earth where the planes don't go. It's very hard to get off the earth. And as a result, there's really not much you can do to get away from it if it were to happen.
Well, I want to go to Antarctica.
Well, yes.
Yeah.
But even in Antarctica, there was a study done a number of years ago. One of these fellows who uses parabolic microphones to record the sounds of nature.
Mm-hmm.
And he says the longest period of time that he existed anywhere in the world, including Antarctica, without hearing human habitation, human people, in one form or another, was about 13 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing.
It's everywhere.
It's the Science Forum on WAMC. 800-348-2551 is the number. Barbara Brabitz is here, and Ed Stander, and Stephen in Glens Falls. Stephen.
Good afternoon. This is a question for Barbara. I've been listening, loved this show, and was hearing you talk about answering a question regarding instinctual behavior and coding and some of the studies using functional MRI. Having seen and worked with MRI units for humans, I'm puzzled. The animals, you can't very well say to them, okay, now I want you to think about a lion attacking you, and we're going to record what your brain shows. You can, show them a lion, if you will, and get them to react. But if they're clamped down in an MRI unit, how are you going to do this? Or if you want them to, activate their predator activities and show them prey, you've got them strapped down in an MRI unit. I'm not understanding the nuts and bolts of that.
Well, you're right. So you have to cajole them, you have to fool them into doing it. So, excuse me, some of the research I've read, it's a lot of mice and rats. So I'll go right there. So a lot of mice and rats, poor guys, that they are strapped down. And they put a screen in front of them, and they habituate them to the screen. So they're kind of like millennial rats, where they're very attuned to watching and experiencing things on a screen. So it's certainly not the same experience. And until we get little portable units where they can kind of wear a helmet and go, I think we're going to only. That's why we haven't really gotten much so far, because you can't really think of a lion with a helmet on running around killing gazelles and like, okay, now go get the, who gets the helmet? Who's the one to go get the helmet off the lion?
Couldn't you use some sort of virtual reality headsets or eyepieces?
That's what I mean by image. They kind of put the screen around them and then create that virtual reality.
I suppose you could make a very huge walk-in MRI, massive. You could put a situation at play.
Well, it's
you could, but the problem is it really needs to be focused, right? Yeah. You're focusing on sections of the brain.
Yeah,
these brains aren't that big.
Yeah.
They're really small.
Yeah. So they've even tried it on insects, which I think is just like crazy that somebody created like a little virtual headset for a cockroach and to see what triggers their pheromone responses.
Well, that's very interesting. Let's take a break here. It's the Science Forum, 800-348-2551. Barbara Brabets is here, Ed Stander, and you. And we'll check the email bag in a moment, then back to the phones we'll go.
Support comes from the Lake George Land Conservancy, Bolton Landing, New York, working on land protection projects that safeguard the water quality of Lake George. Hiking maps, public events, and more at lglc.org. Hadley Garden Center, Hadley, Massachusetts. Locally owned and operated for over 50 years, offering indoor and outdoor plants, gardening supplies, organic fertilizer, and advice. HadleyGardenCenter.com. The Black Sheep, downtown Amherst. A New York-style delicatessen and European-style, all Butterscratch Bakery, Caterer, and Cafe offering free trade coffee. BlackSheepDeli.com. And from George Propane, Goshen, Massachusetts. Family owned and operated for over 75 years. Serving Western Massachusetts with propane and full service heating and plumbing installation and deliveries. GeorgePropane.com.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC, the Science Forum. Ray Graff and you at 800-348-2551. The experts are here, Barbara Brabets and Ed Stander, to answer your questions. And Barbara, the March for Science coming up.
Yes, March for Science Year 2 is scheduled for April 14th. I believe that's a Saturday. And in the that's the Albany March for Science. There will be similar marches throughout the United States, but If you should stay tuned to hear more about the March for Science
who's,
in April.
Who's funding the organization here?
It's really self-funded.
Really?
That's what I know.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
Yep.
And how do we find out more about the March for Science?
I have no idea. I'll let you know
well,
in April.
Well, I'm glad we brought it up.
Yeah, well, I think it's a grassroots organization, and okay. So I'd have to do some grassroots digging in order to find that
out. And when is it?
April 14th.
Okay, we know that. All right, this comes in via email, and this is from Mark. Why do muscles cramp? How is it that some people never seem to get muscle cramps, while others, like myself, suffer periodically from Charlie horses and other types of cramps? What is the science behind cramps?
It's all about the ions, baby.
Yeah?
Ions, ions, ions. So positive ions are critical to muscle tissue, skeletal muscle tissue contraction, and even heart muscle requires mm-hmm. the same stuff. So it's potassium, sodium to a certain extent, but not that much, and then magnesium and calcium. Those are the big four.
So why does Mark have that issue?
Well, it could be that Mark drinks a lot of coffee.
Yeah.
Those people who drink a lot of coffee, it's a diuretic. And so when you shed that in your kidneys, you also shed ions. You shed your electrolytes. So he could have an electrolyte imbalance from too much caffeine. He could have a natural tendency to excrete more ions or he may have a metabolic issue that doesn't allow him to retain ions that well.
So why is it that some cholesterol medication, you always hear people, some people take cholesterol medication, they say, God, I had to go off this. I had terrible Charlie horses.
Yeah.
What happens there?
Well, that's, they're trying to fix that one. It's a complex reaction. It's,
are you having fun today?
I am having. Thanks, okay. Thanks, Ray. Yeah. Just pick all the hard ones without
know.
A blackboard.
I didn't know
Let
it
me
was
draw.
Tough.
No, it's the muscle contractions are dangerous, and yeah. So it is a sign of toxicity.
All right, fair enough. This one is from Anne. I'm in the process of seasoning a cast iron pan. So a chemistry question, I think. I've looked up how to do so online, but there are many conflicting sets of instructions. My question is, most websites say to repeat the process several times, but some say to let the pan cool between seasonings, and some say to just keep adding oil and putting back into the oven, only letting the pan cool enough to handle in between. Which would work best? That's from Anne.
Well, if I can start it, what you're doing is you're polymerizing the oil in the pan. So what you do when you heat it, and then cool it off very slowly, is what you're doing is effectively putting a layer on top of, you're closing up the holes, effectively the pores in the cast iron, by forming a polymer layer of oil at the bottom of that.
Yeah.
So if you think of it that way, then basically what you have to do is just heat it until you, a thin layer until you get the polymerization, and then don't remove it over time by scrubbing the pan.
So you don't have to do it multiple times.
If you do it multiple times, you're just making a thicker and thicker layer of it.
Okay.
It's like dusting your furniture. You can add extra layers if you want.
This is from Rick in Central New York. My dishwasher has developed quite a bit of rust inside. Do you think it's safe to use till replaced, or might there be toxic metals residue left on the dishes? Thanks for your help. Rick in Central New York.
Well, if it's rust, it's probably iron, and iron really is not a safety hazard to most people. There's only a few weird conditions biologically that you can't metabolize iron, but actually iron is probably more of an aesthetic issue than it is a metabolic issue.
And this one is the final email, and then we'll get back to the phones at 800-348-2551. My astronomy prof used to say time travel was possible because all we need to do is approach the speed of light to travel, but getting back would be the issue because to do that you must exceed the speed of light, which is theoretically impossible. But now that we know some things in space, like black hole theory, do escape that speed, and similar to our previous false thought that we could never exceed the speed of sound, isn't it just a matter of time before we can exceed the speed of light and go back to the future? Signed, Marty McFly. There you go.
Well, basically the theory of the speed of light is that as you get closer and closer to the speed of light, you wind up becoming infinitely heavy.
Right.
The mass increases infinitely. So what will happen is if you try to go faster than the speed of light, you'd have to also supposedly, according to the theory that we have, you'd also have to be more than infinitely heavy.
Okay.
And that would be a trick.
Unless there's something on the other side and we don't know what it is. But we don't see any evidence that faster than the speed of light really exists now.
So this gets back to the absence of evidence and the evidence of absence.
Yes, it goes back to that idea.
There is a suggestion that during the first period of time after the Big Bang, that we went through a period of what was called inflation, where things actually moved faster than the speed of light. Hmm. This is a theory by a fellow named Alan Goth. And it's certainly possible, but there's got to be a much, much better explanation than that. We just haven't gotten there yet.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Rick in Albany. Rick, you're on.
Hello, Ray. This is Rick Orlando. I have a silly question, but maybe scientists can help me.
All right.
The computer in my car says when I'm going 50 miles an hour that I'm getting 25 miles per gallon. But when I'm going 75 miles an hour, I'm only getting 20 miles per gallon. Now, doesn't that mean that in an hour I will go 25 miles further at 75 than at 50? And isn't it more efficient to go 75?
But it's the number of gallons that you're burning. You're right. Everything you said so far is right, except the amount of fuel that you're burning to get to that speed and maintain that speed is more. Just think about running. If I said, okay, I'm going to run for an hour, and I could run for an hour at a slow pace versus run for an hour at a fast pace, which one's going to burn more calories, the run for an hour at a fast pace? So it isn't about the length of time. It's really about how much power you're producing, how fast you're going.
All right, but if it says I'm going to be getting 20 miles per gallon because I'm using 20% more fuel, I'm still going instead of going 50 miles in an hour, I'm going 75 miles an hour, I'm going 25 miles more.
Right, but you're burning more
time,
gas.
And only using 20% more gas.
But it's still more gas.
Huh.
Right. Okay.
Hey, well, Chef Rick Orlando, before you go here, maybe you can help us.
Question, man.
How do you season a cast iron pan?
Exactly what I was going to ask.
Very, very easily. Every time I use it, I just brush it with a little bit of neutral oil, and I either put it on stovetop or in the oven for a few minutes, and it works great. You don't have to do a million things to it. Just use an oil that I use sunflower or safflower oil because I know it's not a GMO oil. And I just brush a little bit on and bring it up to heat and cook it for about 10 minutes. It makes the house smell good, warms up the kitchen, and it works forever.
Well, this is very fortuitous that
and
you called us today,
use
man.
Soap.
Don't use soap.
Nobody uses soap or water. No.
Never.
Hey, Rick,
don't
thanks.
Soap breaks down oil. Have a good time.
Yeah, and you know what? Don't speed, man. Stay the speed limit. Thank you very much, sir. Let's go over to Mark in Salem, New York. Mark, you're on.
Yes, I have a question about static electricity, which, of course, in the wintertime is a problem. Air is a good insulator.
Yes.
Water is a good conductor. Why is it that when you take the water out of the air in a room, now I realize that you're separating the electrons from the surface of things when you walk in a dry room, but why is it that the air can conduct the spark a further distance? I've had up to 2-inch sparks. I have to usually go around with a quarter in my hand and hold it up to something. And so why is it that when you take the moisture out of the air, it becomes so easy to get a long spark rather than a shorter one?
Well, you actually answered your question in the statement. If you have water in the air, what happens is you wind up getting rid of the differential in between yourself and the doorknob, so that you don't collect enough static electricity, a static charge, to make a large spark.
Yeah, you discharge little bits.
All the time.
Okay.
It dissipates in the air.
Correct. It dissipates in the air, or it dissipates through the floor, because the floor will be slightly wet. It'll dissipate wherever it can.
And without that moisture, it has to build up, and then zap.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
To the point where you notice.
So how many volts are we talking about? Not a lot of amps, right?
Yeah, 10,000 to 20,000
volts.
Yeah.
Wow, it's incredible. Mark, thanks for the call. I know in our house, we have radiators, and it gets the static can be really bad in the winter.
Well, you just got those speakers, which are electrostatic.
Right.
And what they do effectively is they have two sides, which are very, very high static electricity, and they move a large sheet of mylar in between back and forth, and that makes the sound.
And that's why they respond so quickly, much more so than...
And they'll
cones.
They'll also behave differently depending on how much humidity you have in the air.
Very interesting.
We used to have a cow that really liked the electric fence. And it would, on a dry day, it would rub its back up against the electric fence, and you could hear the crackle, 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 crackle. It was like it had a spot on its back it wanted to itch.
Oh,
and
that's
it
so
would
cool.
just use the power of the electric fence to do it. Obviously, this one was an escape artist because it didn't care about the fence one bit.
You know, if he did it long enough, he'd have a nice fried cow.
Well, it had figured it out through powers of selection, I guess, that this was the thing to do to scratch its back.
Amazing. Nature's wonderful. Let's go to Lisa in Amherst. Lisa, you're on.
Hi. Thank you so much for your show. I really love listening to you every week.
Thank you.
So I have a question about quinine. So I heard a caller earlier saying that something about cramps, and I realized that sometimes I do have leg cramps. And when I drink tonic water, it immediately the cramps go away. And I was just curious why that is.
Well, it's part to the it has to do with those ions again. Quinine is usually expelled pretty quickly from the body. In fact, you can do a time delay study of how long it takes quinine to be absorbed or water to be absorbed in the digestive system, because quinine under a UV light will glow, but your pee normally won't. So what you can do is do time studies of your urine and then look to see when it starts to glow, and that's when the quinine starts to come out. But anyway, your kidneys will excrete the quinine and keep in the ions. So that's why it works.
So it keeps in the ions, and that's why it works.
Yeah.
It's really quite remarkable that it immediately works. So thank you so much for your information. I appreciate it.
Quinine is somewhat toxic if you take a lot of it.
Okay.
So.
But it's good for malaria.
It's
good for
same
a gin
idea.
And tonic, too. Yeah.
It is. It tastes good.
Our number is 800-348-2551. Barbara Brabets is here, Ned Stander. It's the Science Forum. Cynthia in North Carolina. Cynthia, you're on.
Hey there. Enjoying the program. Thank you.
Thank you.
Years ago, I read an autobiography by, I think it was Gordon Cooper, astronaut. And he talked about how the Russians were studying the use of EMT blasts and how effective that would be at war, because it would destroy every living thing but keep the buildings, the infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what are the possibilities of something like that happening? And is it a possibility?
We studied that too, but I think you're confusing
neutron
devices
bombs, yeah.
And EMP is something that's everybody's scared of nowadays, but go ahead. I'll let the scientists talk about it.
Go ahead.
I was on EMP, so I took my thunder,
okay,
so to speak. An electromotive pulse would effectively fry out anything that has electronics in it and make it unable to broadcast. So that would shut down television, cell phone communication, regular telephone.
Automobiles.
Right? Automobiles, unless they have like a condenser, you know, back.
Computers.
You know, as long as they don't. If they were like pre-1970 cars, maybe they would work.
And
maybe.
Would tube radios continue to function, Ed?
I don't think they would, because they
would
blow.
No, they wouldn't, because they wouldn't work either.
Very interesting. But it wouldn't kill people, per se.
Well, isn't there some kind of electromagnetic pulse that could kill people?
I suppose if it was
big
enough.
Well, would it affect your heart?
Well, you know, you could... The speculation about like what was used in Cuba to render those individuals deaf, the people who worked there and were hit with some kind of sound wave, was that it was a test to see how well it worked as an EMP people killer.
Interesting. Well,
and it rendered them deaf.
I know that we did in the early 60s, our government did atmospheric testing of nukes, and they looked at the lines of magnetic lines of the Earth and checked out all this stuff. And some of these high-altitude blasts wiped out power in parts of the Pacific for a brief period of time. So it did work then.
Mm.
And we're more reliant on electronics now. So conceivably, it would be a problem. But the sun could do that as well, Cynthia.
Yeah, a large, I was just thinking that. A large solar flare could knock out most of the satellites in space and do quite a job on the Earth as well.
And that's why they're working on hardening infrastructure today.
And they're talking about one of those flares happening about once every 100 years.
Well, remember the one, they've talked about it, and we've all heard the stories, that these were in the days of telegraph lines, I guess 1880s maybe, and literally reports of sparks going right up the telegraph lines and blowing telegraph operators out of their seats.
Well, the 1960s, that big blackout that affected all the Northeast was
65.
caused by a solar flare hitting the Earth.
Yeah,
right. A lot of my friends were born as a consequence of that blackout.
Our number here quickly is 800-348-2551. Time for a call or two. Let's go to Mark in Rock Hill. Mark.
Hi, lady and gentlemen. Good afternoon to you. I have a question. I hope it's not as ignorant as it sounds to me, but it's still bothering me. When you see traveling at the speed of light portrayed, you know, on TV, on documentaries and all of that, why is it that there seems to be no concern about colliding with anything when you're traveling that fast?
I'd be worried about it.
I would, too.
Yeah.
Me, too, really.
I do know in 1977, when Star Wars came out, they talked about the computer on the Millennium Falcon had to calculate a trajectory that went away from massive objects. So, like, there was a gravitational force against the light, and they had to take that into account in the calculations. When they go to Alderaan, it's blown up, and they're like, you know, there must have been a problem with the navigational computer, and it wasn't. It was just that the Death Star had blown it up.
Yeah.
So,
on the other hand, where there aren't people involved, the amount of stuff that's in space is so small that, well, if you were to take a rocket ship, for example, and shoot it from here to the nearest star, chances are you'd find at the end of it the amount of matter in about a grain of rice.
Really?
There's really nothing out there. That's why it's called space. And
no, I understand that, but what I'm saying is that even when they talk about micrometeorites possibly penetrating the hull of something, right. at the speed of light, you don't have to be as concerned with something like that. Right. I don't get it.
You'd have to be equally concerned, but even in those shows, they very rarely went to the speed of light until they got out of the solar systems. Because once you're out in deep space, there is really very little to have that effect. You won't be seeing things like that. You have maybe a molecule or two, you know, per garbage truck full of material. So, yeah, when you're in the solar system, you have to go slow, and they always show that. And as soon as you get out of the area where this garbage is, it becomes much easier.
By the way, we are out of time, but our producer sent a note here. The Albany March for Science, Saturday, the 14th of April, from 1 to 4 p.m. at West Capitol Park in Albany. Hey, Barbara Bravitz and Ed Stander, thank you for being here today, and thank you for listening, everybody. Support comes from Mass Match. For over 16 years, a locally owned dating and matchmaking service connecting singles through private matchmaking in Western Massachusetts and beyond. MassMatch.com. Vermont Coffee Company, offering slow-roasted organic coffee in the brown paper bag at local grocery stores. Vermont Coffee Company, coffee roasted for friends. Sand Lake Center for the Arts, Averill Park, announcing the play The Crucible through March 25th. Reservations available online at slca-ctp.org. At Wild Bird Junction Backyard Nature Shop, 308 Delaware Avenue, Del Mar, offering wild bird seed, bird feeders, bird houses, bird baths, garden decor, tools, binoculars, chimes, and nature gifts, wildbirdjunction.com. Thanks again to Ed and Barbara for being here today. Thank you for joining us. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Your phones were answered by Colleen O'Connell and Joe Makowicz. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on Food Friday, Bruce Weinstein and Mark Scarborough return to discuss the latest food fad, instant pot cooking. Who knew? Stand by for news.